Black Boy, Disc 3.
Sit down or you'll fall out, Uncle Hoskin shouted.
Let me out, I screamed.
The water now came up to the hubs of the wheels of the buggy. I tried to leap into the river, and he caught hold of my leg. We were now surrounded by water.
Let me out,
I continued to scream. The buggy rolled on, and the water rose higher. The horse wagged his head, arched his neck, flung his tail about, walled his eyes, and snorted. I gripped the sides of the buggy with all the strength I had, ready to wrench free and leap if the buggy slipped deeper into the river. Uncle Hoskins and I tussled.
Whoa!
He yelled at last to the horse. The horse stopped and neighed. The swirling yellow water was so close that I could have touched the surface of the river. Uncle Hoskins looked at me and laughed.
Did you really think that I was going to drive this buggy into the middle of the river?
He asked. I was too scared to answer. My muscles were so taut that they ached.
It's all right, he said soothingly.
He turned the buggy around and started back toward the levee. I was still clutching the sides of the buggy so tightly that I could not turn them loose.
We're safe now, he said.
The buggy rolled onto dry land, and, as my fear ebbed, I felt that I was dropping from a great height. It seemed that I could smell a sharp, fresh odor. My forehead was damp, and my heart thumped heavily.
I want to get out, I said.
What's the matter? He asked.
I want to get out.
We're back on land now, boy.
No, stop. I want to get out.
He did not stop the buggy. He didn't even turn his head to look at me. He didn't understand. I wrenched my leg free with a lunge and leaped headlong out of the buggy, landing in the dust of the road, unhurt. He stopped the buggy.
Are you really that scared?
He asked softly. I didn't answer. I couldn't speak. My fear was gone now, and he loomed before me like a stranger, like a man I had never seen before, a man with whom I could never share a moment of intimate living.
Come on, Richard, and get back into the buggy, he said. I'll take you home now.
I shook my head and began to cry.
Listen, son, don't you trust me? He asked. I was born on that old river. I know that river. There's stone and brick way down under that water. You could wade out for half a mile, and it wouldn't come over your head.
His words meant nothing, and I would not re-enter the buggy.
I'd better take you home, he said soberly.
I started down the dusty road. He got out of the buggy and walked beside me. He didn't do his shopping that day, and when he tried to explain to me what he had been trying to do in frightening me, I wouldn't listen or speak to him. I never trusted him after that. Whenever I saw his face, the memory of my terror upon the river would come back, vivid and strong, and it stood as a barrier between us. Each day, Uncle Hoskins went to his saloon in the evening and didn't return home until the early hours of the morning. Like my father, he slept in the daytime, but noise never seemed to bother Uncle Hoskins. My brother and I shouted and banged as much as we liked. Often I would creep into his room while he slept and stare at his big, shining revolver that lay near his head within quick reach of his hand. I asked Aunt Maggie why he kept the gun so close to him, and she told me that men had threatened to kill him. White men. One morning I awakened to learn that Uncle Hoskins hadn't come home from the saloon. Aunt Maggie fretted and worried. She wanted to visit the saloon and find out what had happened, but Uncle Hoskins had forbidden her to come to the place. The day wore on, and dinner time came.
I'm going to find out if anything's happened, Aunt Maggie said.
Maybe you oughtn't, my mother said. Maybe it's dangerous. The food was kept hot on the stove, and Aunt Maggie stood on the front porch, staring into the deepening dusk. Again, she declared that she was going to the saloon, but my mother dissuaded her once more. It grew dark, and still, he had not come. Aunt Maggie was silent and restless.
I hope to God the white people didn't bother him, she said.
Later, she went into the bedroom, and when she came out, she whimpered,
He didn't take his gun. I wonder what could have happened.
We ate in silence. An hour later, there was the sound of heavy footsteps on the front porch, and a loud knock came. Aunt Maggie ran to the door and flung it open. A tall black boy stood sweating, panting, and shaking his head. He pulled off his cap.
Mr. Hoskins, he done been shot. Done been shot by a white man, the boy gasped. Ms. Hoskins, he dead.
Aunt Maggie screamed and rushed off the porch and down the dusty road into the night.
Maggie,
my mother screamed.
Don't you all go to that saloon,
the boy called.
Maggie,
my mother called, running after Aunt Maggie.
They'll kill you if you go there,
the boy yelled.
White folks say they'll kill all his kinfolks.
My mother pulled Aunt Maggie back to the house. Fear drowned out grief, and that night we packed clothes and dishes and loaded them into a farmer's wagon. Before dawn, we were rolling away, fleeing for our lives. I learned afterwards that Uncle Hoskins had been killed by whites, who had long coveted his flourishing liquor business. He had been threatened with death and warned many times to leave, but he had wanted to hold on a while longer to amass more money. We got rooms in West Helena, and Aunt Maggie and my mother kept huddled in the house all day and night, afraid to be seen on the streets. Finally, Aunt Maggie defied her fear and made frequent trips back to Elaine. But she went in secret and at night and would tell no one save my mother when she was going. There was no funeral. There was no music. There was no period of mourning. There were no flowers. There were only silence, quiet weeping, whispers, and fear. I didn't know when or where Uncle Hoskins was buried. Aunt Maggie wasn't even allowed to see his body, nor was she able to claim any of his assets. Uncle Hoskins had simply been plucked from our midst, and we, figuratively, had fallen on our faces to avoid looking in to that white-hot face of terror that we knew loomed somewhere above us. This was as close as white terror had ever come to me, and my mind reeled. Why had we not fought back? I asked my mother, and the fear that was in her made her slap me into silence. Shocked, frightened, alone without their husbands or friends, my mother and Aunt Maggie lost faith in themselves, and after much debate and hesitation, they decided to return home to Granny and rest, think, map out new plans for living. I had grown used to moving suddenly, and the prospects of another trip didn't excite me. I'd learned to leave old places without regret and to accept new ones for what they looked like. Though I was nearly 9 years of age, I hadn't had a single unbroken year of school, and I wasn't conscious of it. I could read and count, and that was about as much as most of the people I met could do, grown-ups or children. Again, our household was torn apart. Belongings were sold, given away, or simply left behind, and we were off for another long train ride. A few days later, after we had arrived at Granny's, I was playing alone in a wild field, digging in the ground with an old knife. Suddenly, a strange, rhythmic sound made me turn my head. Flowing threateningly toward me, over the crest of a hill, was a wave of black men draped in weird, mustard-colored clothing. Unconsciously, I jumped to my feet, my heart pounding. What was this? Were these men coming after me? Line by line, row by row, the fantastic men in their wild colors were descending straight at me, trotting, their feet pounding the earth like someone beating a vast drum. I wanted to fly home, but, as in a dream, I couldn't move. I cast about wildly for a clue to tell me what this was, but I could find nothing. The wall of men was drawing closer. My heart was beating so strongly that it shook my body. Again, I tried to run, but I couldn't budge. My mother's name was on the tip of my tongue, and I opened my mouth to scream, but no words came, for now the surging men, each looking exactly like the other, parted and poured around me, jarring the earth, their feet stomping in unison. As they flooded past, I saw that their black faces were looking at me, and that some of them were smiling. Then I noticed that each man was holding a long, dark, heavy, stick-like object upon his shoulder. One of the men yelled something at me, which I didn't understand. They were past me now, disappearing in a great cloud of brown dust that looked like a part of their clothing, that made them seem akin to the elemental earth itself. As soon as they were far enough away for me to conquer my fear, I dashed home and babbled to my mother what I had seen, asking her who the strange men were.
"Those were soldiers," she said.
"What are soldiers?" I asked.
"Men who fight in wars."
"Why do they fight?"
"Because their country tells them to."
"And what are those long black sticks they have on their shoulders?"
"Rifles."
"What's a rifle?"
"It's a gun that shoots a bullet."
"Like a pistol?"
"Yes."
"Would the bullet kill you?"
"Yes, if it hits you in the right place."
"Who are they going to shoot?"
"Germans."
"Who are Germans?"
"They are the enemy."
"What's an enemy?"
"The people who want to kill you and take your country away from you."
"Where do they live?"
"Way across the sea," my mother explained. "Don't you remember that I told you that war has been declared?" I remembered. But when she had told me, it hadn't seemed at all important. I asked my mother what the war was about, and she spoke of England, France, Russia, Germany, of men dying. But the reality of it was too vast and alien for me to be moved or further interested. Upon another day, I was playing out of doors in front of the house, and I accidentally looked down the road and saw what seemed to me to be a herd of elephants coming slowly toward me. There was in me this time none of that naked terror I had felt when I had seen the soldiers, for these strange creatures were moving slowly, silently, with no suggestion of threat. Yet I edged cautiously toward the steps of the house, holding myself ready to run if they should prove to be more violent than they appeared. The strange elephants were a few feet from me now, and I saw that their faces were like the faces of men. I stared, my mind trying to adjust memory to reality. What kind of men were these? I saw that there were two lines of creatures that looked like men on either side of the road, and that there were a few white faces and a great many black faces. I saw that the white faces were the faces of white men, and they were dressed in ordinary clothing, but the black faces were men wearing what seemed to me to be elephants' clothing. As the strange animals came abreast of me, I saw that the legs of the black animals were held together by irons, and that their arms were linked with heavy chains that clanked softly and musically as they moved. The black creatures were digging a shallow ditch on each side of the road, working silently, grunting as they lifted spades of earth and flung them into the middle of the roadway. One of the strange striped animals turned a black face upon me.
"What are you doing?" I asked in a whisper, not knowing if one actually spoke to elephants. He shook his head and cast his eyes guardedly back at a white man, then dug on again. Suddenly I noticed that the white men were holding the long, heavy black sticks, rifles, on their shoulders. After they had passed, I ran breathlessly into the house.
"Mama!" I yelled.
"What?" she answered from the kitchen.
"There are elephants in the street."
She came to the kitchen door and stared at me.
"Elephants?" she asked.
"Yes, come and see them. They're digging in the street."
My mother dried her hands on her apron and rushed to the front door. I followed, wanting her to interpret the baffling spectacle I had seen. She looked out of the door and shook her head.
"Those are not elephants," she said.
"What are they?"
"That's a chain gang."
"What's a chain gang?"
"It's just what you see," she said. "A gang of men chained together and made to work."
"Why?"
"Because they've done something wrong, and they're being punished."
"What do they do?"
"I don't know."
"But why do they look like that?"
"That's to keep them from running away," she said. "You see, everybody will know that they're convicts because of their stripes."
"Why don't the white men wear stripes?"
"They're the guards."
"Do white men ever wear stripes?"
"Sometime."
"Did you ever see any?"
"No."
"Why are there so many black men wearing stripes?"
"It's because, well, they're harder on black people."
"The white people?"
"Yes."
"Then why don't all the black men fight all the white men out there? There are more black men than white men."
"But the white men have guns and the black men don't," my mother said.
She looked at me and asked,
"What made you call them elephants?"
I could not answer her at that moment. But later, brooding over the black and white striped clothing of the black men, I remembered that in a lane, I had had a book that carried the gaudy pictures and names of jungle beasts. What had struck me most vividly were the striped zebras that looked as if someone had painted them. The other animals that had gripped my imagination were the elephants, and by association, the zebras and the elephants had become linked and identified in my mind to such an extent that when I had seen the convicts dressed in the white and black stripes of zebras, I had thought they were elephants, beasts of the jungle. Again, after an undetermined stretch of time, my mother announced that we were going to move, that we were going back to West Helena. She had grown tired of the strict religious routine of Granny's home, of the half dozen or more daily family prayers that Granny insisted upon, her fiat that the day began at sunrise and that night commenced at sundown, the long, rambling Bible readings, the individual invocations muttered at each meal, and her declaration that Saturday was the Lord's Sabbath, and that no one who lived in her house could work upon that day. In West Helena, we could have a home of our own, a condition that now loomed desirable after a few months of Granny's anxiety about the state of our souls. Naturally, a trip was agreeable to me. Again we packed. Again we said goodbye. Again we rode the train. Again we were in West Helena. We rented one half of a double corner house, in front of which ran a stagnant ditch carrying sewage. The neighborhood swarmed with rats, cats, dogs, fortune tellers, cripples, blind men, whores, salesmen, rent collectors, and children. In front of our flat was a huge roundhouse where locomotives were cleaned and repaired. There was an eternal hissing of steam, the deep grunting of steel engines, and the tolling of bells. Smoke obscured the vision, and cinders drifted into the house, into our beds, into our kitchen, into our food, and a tar-like smell was always in the air. Bareheaded and barefooted, my brother and I, along with nameless and countless other black children, used to stand and watch the men crawl in, out, over, and under the huge black metal engines. When the men were not looking, we would climb into the engineer's cab and pull our small bodies to the window and look out, imagining that we were grown and had got a job as an engineer running a train, and that it was night, and there was a storm, and we had a long string of passenger cars behind us, trying to get them safely home. "Woo-wee," we would say, "thong, thong, thong, huff, 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 huff," we would say. But our greatest fun came from waiting in the sewage ditch, where we found old bottles, tin cans that held tiny crawfish, rusty spoons, bits of metal, old toothbrushes, dead cats and dogs, and occasional pennies. We made wooden boats out of cigar boxes, devised wooden paddles to which we twisted pieces of rubber, and sent the cigar box boats sailing down the ditch under their own power. Many evenings, the fathers of the children would come out, take off their shoes, and make and sail the boats themselves. My mother and Aunt Maggie cooked in the kitchens of white folks, and my brother and I were free to wander where we pleased during their working hours. Each day, we were left a dime apiece to spend for lunch, and all morning we would dream and discuss what we would buy. At 10 or 11 o'clock, we would go to the corner grocery, owned by a Jew, and buy a nickel's worth of ginger snaps and a bottle of Coca-Cola. That was lunch, as we understood it. I had never seen a Jew before, and the proprietor of the grocery store was a strange thing in my life. Until that time, I had never heard a foreign language spoken, and I used to linger at the door of the grocery store to hear the odd sounds that Jews made when they talked. All of us black people who lived in the neighborhood hated Jews, not because they exploited us, but because we had been taught at home and in Sunday school that Jews were Christ killers. With the Jews thus singled out for us, we made them fair game for ridicule. We black children, 7, 8, and 9 years of age, used to run to the Jew's store and shout, "Jew, Jew, Jew, what do you chew?" Or we would form a long line and weave back and forth in front of the door, singing, "Jew, Jew, 2, 4, 5, that's what keeps Jew alive." Or we would chant, "Bloody Christ killers, never trust a Jew. Bloody Christ killers, what won't a Jew do?" To one of the red-headed Jewish boys we sang, "Red head, Jewish bread, 5 cents a Jewish head." To the fat Jewish woman we sneered, "Red, white, and blue, your pa was a Jew. Your ma a dirty Dago, what the hell is you?" And when the bald-headed proprietor would pass by, we black children, poor, half-starved, ignorant, victims of racial prejudice, would sing with a proud lilt, "A rotten egg never fries, a cheating dog never thrives." There were many more folk ditties, some mean, others filthy, all of them cruel. No one ever thought of questioning our right to do this. Our mothers and parents generally approved, either actively or passively. To hold an attitude of antagonism or distrust toward Jews was bred in us from childhood. It was not merely racial prejudice. It was part of our cultural heritage. One afternoon, a group of black boys and girls were standing about outside playing, laughing, talking. A black man dressed in overalls went up the steps and into the flat adjoining the one in which I lived.
"This is Saturday,"
a black girl said to me.
"Yeah, but why you say it?"
I asked.
"They're going to make a lot of money in there today,"
she said, pointing to the door through which the man had disappeared.
"How?"
Another black man went up the steps and into the flat.
"Don't you know?"
the girl asked, incredulous.
"Know what?" "What they selling?"
"Where?"
"In there where them men went,"
she said.
"Nobody sells things in there,"
I said.
"You kidding?"
the girl said in honest disbelief.
"I ain't what they selling. Tell me." "You know what they selling,"
she said, looking at me with a teasing smile.
"They don't sell nothing in there,"
I said.
"Ah, you just a baby,"
she said, slapping her dingy palm through the air at me in a contemptuous gesture. I was puzzled. Was there something happening next door to where I lived that I didn't know? I thought I had poked my nose into every bit of conceivable business in the neighborhood. If something was being sold next door, then I certainly wanted to know about it. The building in which I lived was a double-frame house of one story. The building originally had been a one-dwelling unit and had been converted into two flats, for there were doors in our flat that led into the flat adjoining. These doors had been locked, bolted, and nailed securely. The family next door seemed quiet. Men came and went, but that didn't seem odd to me. But now, the girl's hints made me want to know what was happening over there. I entered our house and locked the door, then put my ear to the thin wall that divided the two flats and listened. I heard faint sounds, but could make nothing of them. I listened at a bolted door, and the sounds came a little louder, but I still could understand nothing. Quietly, I pulled up a chair, placed a box upon it, and climbed up, and peered through a crack at the top of the door. I saw, in the dim shadows of the room beyond, a naked man and a naked woman upon a bed, the man on top of the woman. I lost my balance and toppled backwards to the floor. I lay still, wondering if the man and woman next door had heard me. But all seemed quiet, and my curiosity returned. Just as I had climbed up again to look, a sharp rapping came on the window pane behind me. I turned my head and saw the landlady from next door looking at me. My heart thumped and I scrambled down. The landlady's black face was pressed hard against the window pane. Her mouth was moving violently and her eyes were glaring. I was afraid to stay in the house or go out. Evidently, I had done something terrible, if the wild anger written on the woman's face was any indication. Her face went from the window, and a moment later, a loud pounding came at the front door.
"Open this door, you boy!"
I trembled and didn't answer.
"Open this door or I'll have to break it."
"My mama ain't here,"
I said vaguely.
"This is my house and you open this door,"
she shouted. Her voice overpowered me and I opened the door. She rushed in, then stopped and stared at the clumsy scaffolding I had rigged up to look into her flat. Why hadn't I taken it down before I opened the door?
"Boy, what do you mean?"
she asked. I couldn't answer.
"You scared my customers,"
she said.
"Customers?"
I repeated vaguely.
"You little snot," she blazed. "I got a good mind to beat you."
"No, you won't,"
I said.
"I want to make your folks move out of here,"
she railed.
"I got to make a living, and you go and spoil my Saturday for me?"
I was just looking."
"Looking?"
She smiled suddenly, relenting a little.
"Why don't you come on over like the rest and spend a quarter?"
"I don't want to go to your old house,"
I told her with my 9-year-old indignation.
"You're a plague,"
she said, deciding that I wouldn't be a customer.
"I'm going to get you out of here."
When my mother and Aunt Maggie came home that night, there was a scalding argument. The women shouted at each other over the wooden railings on the front porch, and their voices could be heard for half a mile. Neighbors listened. Children gathered and gaped. The argument boiled down to one issue. The landlady demanded that my mother beat me, and for once, my mother refused.
"You oughtn't have that in your house," my mother told her. "It's my house, and I'll have in it what I damn please,"
the landlady said.
"I wouldn't have moved in here if I had thought you were running that kind of business,"
my mother said.
"Don't talk to me like that, you high-toned bitch,"
the landlady shouted.
"What do you expect children to do when you do that?"
my mother asked.
"Them bastard brats of yours ain't no angels,"
the landlady said.
"You're just a common prostitute,"
Aunt Maggie pitched in.
"And what kind of whore is you?"
the landlady shouted.
"Don't you talk to my sister like that,"
my mother warned.
"Pack up your rags, you black bastards, and get,"
the landlady ordered. It ended with our packing and moving that night into another frame house on the same street, a few doors away. I still had only a hazy notion of what the landlady was selling. The boys later told me the name of it, but I had no exact conception of it in my mind. Though I knew that others felt it was something terribly bad, I was still curious. In time, I would find out what it was. Something secret was happening in our house, and it had reached a serious stage before I knew it. Each night, just as I was dozing off to sleep, I would hear a light tapping on Aunt Maggie's windowpane, a door creaking open, whispers, then long silences. Once I got out of bed and crept to the door of the front room and stole a look. There was a well-dressed black man sitting on the sofa, talking in a soft voice to Aunt Maggie. Why was it that I couldn't meet the man? I crept back to bed, but was awakened later by low voices saying goodbye. The next morning I asked my mother who had been in the house, and she told me that no one had been there.
"But I heard a man talking," I said.
"You didn't," she said. "You were sleeping."
"But I saw a man. He was in the front room."
"You were dreaming," my mother said. I learned a part of the secret of the night visits one Sunday morning when Aunt Maggie called me and my brother to her room and introduced us to the man who was going to be our new uncle, a Professor Matthews. He wore a high, snow-white collar and rimless eyeglasses. His lips were thin, and his eyelids seemed never to blink. I felt something cold and remote in him, and when he called me, I wouldn't go to him. He sensed my distrust and softened me up with the gift of a dime, then knelt and prayed for us two poor, fatherless young men, as he called us. After prayer, Aunt Maggie told us that she and Professor Matthews were leaving soon for the North. I was saddened, for I had grown to feel that Aunt Maggie was another mother to me. I didn't meet the new uncle again, though each morning I saw evidences of his having been in the house. My brother and I were puzzled, and we speculated as to what our new uncle could be doing. Why did he always come at night? Why did he always speak in so subdued a voice, hardly above a whisper? And how did he get the money to buy such white collars and such nice blue suits? To add to our bewilderment, our mother called us to her one day and cautioned us against telling anyone that Uncle ever visited us, that people were looking for Uncle.
"What people?"
I asked.
White people, my mother said. Anxiety entered my body. Somewhere in the unknown, the white threat was hovering near again.
What do they want with him?
I asked. You never mind, my mother said.
What did he do?
You keep your mouth shut, or the white folks will get you too, she warned me. Knowing that we were frightened and baffled about our new uncle, my mother, I guess, urged Aunt Maggie to tell Uncle to bribe us into silence and trust. Every morning now was like Christmas. We would climb out of bed and race to the kitchen and look on the table to see what Uncle had left for us. One morning, I found that he had brought me a little female poodle, upon which I bestowed the name of Betsy, and she became my pet and companion. Strangely, Uncle began visiting us in the daytime now. But when he came, all the shades in the house were drawn, and we were forbidden to go out of doors until he left. I asked my mother 1,000 whispered questions about the silent, black, educated uncle, and she always replied, "It's something you can't know. Now keep quiet and go play." One night, the sound of sobbing awakened me. I got up and went softly to the front room and peeped around the jamb of the door. There was Uncle, sitting on the floor by the window, peering into the night from under the lifted curtain. My mother was bent over a small trunk, packing hurriedly. Fear gripped me. Was my mother leaving? Why was Aunt Maggie crying? Were the white people coming after us? "Hurry up," Uncle said. "We must get out of here." "Oh, Maggie," my mother said, "I don't know if you ought to go." "You keep out of this," Uncle said, still peering into the dark street.
"But what did you do?"
Aunt Maggie asked. "I'll tell you later," Uncle said. "We got to get out of here before they come."
"But you've done something terrible," Aunt Maggie said, "or you wouldn't be running like this."
"The house is on fire," Uncle said. "And when they see it, they'll know who did it."
"Did you set the house afire?"
my mother asked. "There was nothing else to do," Uncle said impatiently. "I took the money. I'd hit her. She was unconscious. If they found her, she'd tell. I'd be lost, so I set the fire."
"But she'll burn up,"
Aunt Maggie said, crying into her hands.
"What could I do?" Uncle asked. "I had to do it. I couldn't just leave her there and let somebody find her. They'd know somebody hit her. But if she burns, nobody'll ever know."
Fear filled me. What was happening? Were white people coming after all of us? Was my mother going to leave me?
"Mama," I wailed, running into the room.
Uncle leaped to his feet. A gun was in his hand, and he was pointing it at me. I stared at the gun, feeling that I was going to die at any moment.
"Richard,"
my mother whispered fiercely.
"You're going away," I yelled.
My mother rushed to me and clapped her hand over my mouth.
"Do you want us all to be killed?"
she asked, shaking me. I quieted.
"Now you go back to sleep," she said.
"You're leaving," I said.
"I'm not."
"You are leaving. I see the trunk," I wailed.
"You stop that noise," my mother said,
and she caught my arms in so tight a grip of fury that my crying ceased because of the pain.
"Now you get back to bed."
She led me back to bed, and I lay awake, listening to whispers, footsteps, doors creaking in the dark, and the sobs of Aunt Maggie. Finally, I heard the sound of a horse and buggy rolling up to the house. I heard the scraping of a trunk being dragged across the floor. Aunt Maggie came into my room, crying softly. She kissed me and whispered goodbye. She kissed my brother, who did not even waken. Then she was gone. The next morning, my mother called me into the kitchen and talked to me for a long time, cautioning me that I must never mention what I had seen and heard, that white people would kill me if they even thought I knew.
Know what?
I could not help but ask.
Never you mind now, she said. Forget what you saw last night.
But what did Uncle do?
I can't tell you.
He killed somebody,
I ventured timidly.
If anybody heard you say that, you'll die,
my mother said. That settled it for me. I would never mention it. A few days later, a tall white man, with a gleaming star on his chest and a gun on his hip, came to the house. He talked with my mother a long time, and all I could hear was my mother's voice.
I don't know what you're talking about. Search the house if you like.
The tall white man looked at me and my brother, but he said nothing to us. For weeks I wondered what it was that Uncle had done, but I was destined never to know, not even in all the years that followed. With Aunt Maggie gone, my mother could not earn enough to feed us, and my stomach kept so consistently empty that my head ached most of the day. One afternoon, hunger haunted me so acutely that I decided to try to sell my dog Betsy and buy some food. Betsy was a tiny, white, fluffy poodle, and when I had washed, dried, and combed her, she looked like a toy. I tucked her under my arm and went for the first time alone into a white neighborhood where there were wide, clean streets and big white houses. I went from door to door, ringing the bells. Some white people slammed the door in my face. Others told me to come to the rear of the house, but pride would never let me do that. Finally, a young white woman came to the door and smiled.
"What do you want?" she asked. "Do you want to buy a pretty dog?" I asked. "Let me see it."
She took the dog into her arms and fondled and kissed it.
"What's its name?"
"Betsy."
"She is cute," she said. "What do you want for her?"
"A dollar," I said.
"Wait a moment," she said. "Let me see if I have a dollar."
She took Betsy into the house with her, and I waited on the porch, marveling at the cleanliness, the quietness of the white world. How orderly everything was. Yet I felt out of place. I had no desire to live here. Then I remembered that these houses were the homes in which lived those white people who made Negroes leave their homes and flee into the night. I grew tense. Would someone say that I was a bad nigger and try to kill me here? What was keeping the woman so long? Would she tell other people that a nigger boy had said something wrong to her? Perhaps she was getting a mob. Maybe I ought to leave now and forget about Betsy. My mounting anxieties drowned out my hunger. I wanted to rush back to the safety of the black faces I knew. The door opened, and the woman came out, smiling, still hugging Betsy in her arms. But I couldn't see her smile now. My eyes were full of the fears I had conjured up.
"I just love this dog," she said, "and I'm going to buy her. I haven't got a dollar. All I have is 97 cents.
Though she didn't know it, she was now giving me my opportunity to ask for my dog without saying that I didn't want to sell her to white people.
"No, ma'am," I said softly. "I want a dollar."
"But I haven't got a dollar in the house," she said.
"Then I can't sell the dog," I said.
"I'll give you the other 3 cents when my mother comes home tonight," she said.
"No, ma'am,"
I said, looking stonily at the floor.
"But listen, you said you wanted a dollar."
"Yes, ma'am, a dollar."
"Then here is 97 cents, she said, extending a handful of change to me, still holding on to Betsy.
"No, ma'am," I said, shaking my head. "I want a dollar."
"But I'll give you the other 3 cents.
"My mama told me to sell her for a dollar," I said,
feeling that I was being too aggressive and trying to switch the moral blame for my aggressiveness to my absent mother.
You'll get a dollar. You'll get the 3 cents tonight.
No, ma'am.
Then leave the dog and come back tonight.
No, ma'am.
But what could you want with a dollar now? She asked.
I want to buy something to eat, I said.
Then 97 cents will buy a lot of food, she said.
No, ma'am. I want my dog.
She stared at me for a moment, and her face grew red.
Here's your dog, she snapped, thrusting Betsy into my arms. Now get away from here. You're just about the craziest nigger boy I ever did see.
I took Betsy and ran all the way home, glad that I hadn't sold her. But my hunger returned. Maybe I ought to have taken the 97 cents. But it was too late now. I hugged Betsy in my arms and waited. When my mother came home that night, I told her what had happened.
And you didn't take the money? She asked.
No, ma'am.
Why?
I don't know, I said uneasily.
Don't you know that 97 cents is almost a dollar? She asked.
Yes, ma'am, I said, counting on my fingers. 98, 99, 100. But I didn't want to sell Betsy to white people.
Why?
Because they're white, I said.
You're foolish, my mother said. A week later, Betsy was crushed to death beneath the wheels of a coal wagon. I cried and buried her in the backyard and drove a barrel staving into the ground at the head of her grave. My mother's sole comment was,
"You could have had a dollar, but you can't eat a dead dog, can you?"
I didn't answer. Up or down the wet or dusty streets, indoors or out, the days and nights began to spell out magic possibilities. If I pulled a hair from a horse's tail and sealed it in a jar of my own urine, the hair would turn overnight into a snake. If I passed a Catholic sister, a mother dressed in black, and smiled and allowed her to see my teeth, I would surely die. If I walked under a leaning ladder, I would certainly have bad luck. If I kissed my elbow, I would turn into a girl. If my right ear itched, then something good was being said about me by somebody. If I touched a hunchback's hump, then I would never be sick. If I placed a safety pin on a steel railroad track and let a train run over it, the safety pin would turn into a pair of bright, brand new scissors. If I heard a voice, and no human being was near, then either God or the devil was trying to talk to me. Whenever I made urine, I should spit into it for good luck. If my nose itched, somebody was going to visit me. If I mocked a crippled man, then God would make me crippled. If I used the name of God in vain, then God would strike me dead. If it rained while the sun was shining, then the devil was beating his wife. If the stars twinkled more than usual on any given night, it meant that the angels in heaven were happy and were flitting across the doors of heaven. And since stars were merely holes ventilating heaven, the twinkling came from the angels flitting past the holes that admitted air into the holy home of God. If I broke a mirror, I would have 7 years of bad luck. If I was good to my mother, I would grow old and rich. If I had a cold and tied a worn, dirty sock about my throat before I went to bed, the cold would be gone the next morning. If I wore a bit of asafoetida in a little bag tied about my neck, I would never catch a disease. If I looked at the sun through a piece of smoked glass on an Easter Sunday morning, I would see the sun shouting in praise of a risen Lord. If a man confessed anything on his deathbed, it was the truth. For no man could stare death in the face and lie. If you spat on each grain of corn that was planted, the corn would grow tall and bear well. If I spilt salt, I should toss a pinch of it over my left shoulder to ward off misfortune. If I covered a mirror when a storm was raging, the lightning would not strike me. If I stepped over a broom that was lying on the floor, I would have bad luck. If I walked in my sleep, then God was trying to lead me somewhere to do a good deed for him. Anything seemed possible, likely, feasible, because I wanted everything to be possible. Because I had no power to make things happen outside of me in the objective world, I made things happen within. Because my environment was bare and bleak, I endowed it with unlimited potentialities, redeemed it for the sake of my own hungry and cloudy yearning. A dread of white people now came to live permanently in my feelings and imagination. As the war drew to a close, racial conflict flared over the entire South, and though I didn't witness any of it, I couldn't have been more thoroughly affected by it if I had participated directly in every clash. The war itself had been unreal to me, but I had grown able to respond emotionally to every hint, whisper, word, inflection, news, gossip, and rumor regarding conflicts between the races. Nothing challenged the totality of my personality so much as this pressure of hate and threat that stemmed from the invisible whites. I would stand for hours on the doorsteps of neighbors' houses, listening to their talk, learning how a white woman had slapped a black woman, how a white man had killed a black man. It filled me with awe, wonder, and fear, and I asked ceaseless questions. One evening, I heard a tale that rendered me sleepless for nights. It was of a Negro woman whose husband had been seized and killed by a mob. It was claimed that the woman vowed she would avenge her husband's death, and she took a shotgun, wrapped it in a sheet, and went humbly to the whites, pleading that she be allowed to take her husband's body for burial. It seemed that she was granted permission to come to the side of her dead husband, while the whites, silent and armed, looked on. The woman, so went the story, knelt and prayed, then proceeded to unwrap the sheet, and before the white men realized what was happening, she had taken the gun from the sheet and had slain four of them, shooting at them from her knees. I didn't know if the story was factually true or not, but it was emotionally true, because I had already grown to feel that there existed men against whom I was powerless, men who could violate my life at will. I resolved that I would emulate the black woman if I were ever faced with a white mob. I would conceal a weapon, pretend that I had been crushed by the wrong done to one of my loved ones. Then, just when they thought I had accepted their cruelty as the law of my life, I would let go with my gun and kill as many of them as possible before they killed me. The story of the woman's deception gave form and meaning to confused defensive feelings that had long been sleeping in me. My imaginings, of course, had no objective value whatever. My spontaneous fantasies lived in my mind because I felt completely helpless in the face of this threat that might come upon me at any time, and because there didn't exist, to my knowledge, any possible course of action which could have saved me if I had ever been confronted with a white mob. My fantasies were a moral bulwark that enabled me to feel I was keeping my emotional integrity whole, a support that enabled my personality to limp through days lived under the threat of violence. These fantasies were no longer a reflection of my reaction to the white people. They were a part of my living, of my emotional life. They were a culture, a creed, a religion. The hostility of the whites had become so deeply implanted in my mind and feelings that it had lost direct connection with the daily environment in which I lived. And my reactions to this hostility fed upon itself, grew or diminished according to the news that reached me about the whites, according to what I aspired or hoped for. Tension would set in at the mere mention of whites, and a vast complex of emotions involving the whole of my personality would be aroused. It was as though I was continuously reacting to the threat of some natural force whose hostile behavior couldn't be predicted. I had never in my life been abused by whites, but I had already become as conditioned to their existence as though I had been the victim of 1,000 lynchings. I lived in West Helena an undeterminedly long time before I returned to school and took up regular study. My mother luckily secured a job in a white doctor's office at the unheard-of wages of $5 per week, and at once she announced that her sons were going to school again. I was happy, but I was still shy and half paralyzed when in the presence of a crowd, and my first day at the new school made me the laughingstock of the classroom. I was sent to the blackboard to write my name and address. I knew my name and address, knew how to write it, knew how to spell it. But standing at the blackboard, with the eyes of the many girls and boys looking at my back, made me freeze inside, and I was unable to write a single letter.
"Write your name," the teacher called to me.
I lifted the white chalk to the blackboard, and as I was about to write, my mind went blank, empty. I couldn't remember my name, not even the first letter. Somebody giggled, and I stiffened.
"Just forget us and write your name and address," the teacher coaxed.
An impulse to write would flash through me, but my hand would refuse to move. The children began to twitter, and I flushed hotly.
"Don't you know your name?" the teacher asked.
I looked at her and couldn't answer. The teacher rose and walked to my side, smiling at me to give me confidence. She placed her hand tenderly upon my shoulder.
"What's your name?" she asked.
"Richard," I whispered.
"Richard what?"
"Richard Wright."
"Spell it."
I spelled my name in a wild rush of letters, trying desperately to redeem my paralyzing shyness.
"Spell it slowly so I can hear it," she directed me.
I did.
"Now, can you write?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Then write it."
Again, I turned to the blackboard and lifted my hand to write. Then I was blank and void within. I tried frantically to collect my senses, but I could remember nothing. A sense of the girls and boys behind me filled me to the exclusion of everything. I realized how utterly I was failing, and I grew weak and leaned my hot forehead against the cold blackboard. The room burst into a loud and prolonged laugh, and my muscles froze.
"You may go to your seat," the teacher said.
I sat and cursed myself. Why did I always appear so dumb when I was called upon to perform something in a crowd? I knew how to write as well as any pupil in the classroom, and no doubt I could read better than any of them, and I could talk fluently and expressively when I was sure of myself. Then why did strange faces make me freeze? I sat, with my ears and neck burning, hearing the pupils whisper about me, hating myself, hating them. I sat still as a stone, and a storm of emotion surged through me. While sitting in class one day, I was startled to hear whistles blowing and bells ringing. Soon the bedlam was deafening. The teacher lost control of her class, and the girls and boys ran to the windows. The teacher left the room, and when she returned, she announced,
"Everybody, pack your things and go home."
"Why?
What's happened?"
"The war is over," the teacher said. I followed the rest of the children into the streets and saw that white and black people were laughing and singing and shouting. I felt afraid as I pushed through crowds of white people, but my fright left when I entered my neighborhood and saw smiling black faces. I wandered among them, trying to realize what war was. what it meant, and I could not. I noticed that many girls and boys were pointing at something in the sky. I looked up too, and saw what seemed to be a tiny bird wheeling and sailing.
Look, a plane!
I had never seen a plane.
It's a bird, I said.
The crowd laughed.
That's a plane, boy,
a man said.
It's a bird, I said. I see it.
A man lifted me upon his shoulder.
Boy, remember this, he said. You're seeing man fly.
I still did not believe it. It still looked like a bird to me. That night at home, my mother convinced me that men could fly. Christmas came, and I had but one orange. I was hurt. I wouldn't go out to play with the neighborhood children who were blowing horns and shooting firecrackers. I nursed my orange all of Christmas Day. At night, just before going to bed, I ate it, first taking a bite out of the top and sucking the juice from it as I squeezed it. Finally, I tore the peeling into bits and munched them slowly.
This ends Disc 3.